Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by The Isley Brothers, The Carpenters, The Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Hey, this is Nicole calling from Hamilton, and I needed to let everyone know that I really proudly support Vish and Creative Control. I have for many years, I will for many more, as long as he keeps delivering these amazing interview podcasts. When you hear one of Vish's interviews, you think he's known this guest for years, they're good friends, but the truth is he approaches every interview, whether it's sort of up-and-coming indie artists or established icons or like famous intimidating comedians with a really deep, genuine curiosity, so he's never met this person, and the same really warm candor, as so he's known them forever. I think it really lends to a great chat, no matter who he's talking to, and for that reason, I think you should throw Vish, like what, $1 a month? He's got jokes. The jokes make it worth it. Support Creative Control on Patreon.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I'm Visha's wife, and remember, when you name a dog Janet or Timothy, you are dragging humanity down just a little bit.
Corey Hansen is a gifted musician based in Los Angeles, California. A member of the band Wand, Hansen is also a solo artist whose wonderful second album will be released on April 16th, 2021 by Drag City Records. It's called Pale Horse Rider, and it prompted Corey and I to have a wonderful conversation about time he's spent living in California and New York. the pervasiveness of the term bodega in contemporary times, the health of DIY art spaces in Los Angeles, and waves of gentrification, how a pandemic suits the natural rhythms of a touring musician, those Las Vegas nights, the humor and public postures of Neil Young and Bob Dylan, what it was like working with Bonnie Prince Billy and Bill Callahan on a song, songwriting tutelage he received from the late David Berman, and David's influence on his new album, future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol and Massey Hall's concert film series live at masseyhall.com, where you can stream dozens of 30-minute films for free, including performances by past podcast guests like Andy Schaaf, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 608th episode of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Corey Hansen, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hey, Corey, how's it going?
Hey, Vish, how's it going?
I'm well. It's nice to speak with you. Where in the world are you today?
I am in the San Gabriel Valley. It's so near Pasadena and probably 10 miles northeast of downtown Los Angeles.
I see. That is very specific. You are so specific with your geographic pinpointing. I really appreciate that. Is this an area you know well? Is this an area you've lived in a long time?
Oh, yeah. I've lived here my whole life. This is my zone.
I see. Yeah. Never had the urge to try out another place? Have you ever lived anywhere else?
I have attempted to live in New York, in Brooklyn, in 2011, once I graduated college. But I ultimately came back with my tail between my legs. Mm. Haven't had the urge or felt the need to fly away too far from my nest. as a touring professional or a newly retired touring professional,
yes,
I have not really felt the need to be anywhere because I've been all over the place. And as a part of my job, it's kind of nice to just come home to some place that's very familiar.
Right. Now, were you attending university or college in New York? Is that why you mentioned that?
No. I went to California Institute of the Arts in Santa Clarita.
Oh, I see. So you graduated and you're like, I've been in California my whole life. I'm going to try New York. That was it?
Yeah, I had a bunch of friends out there and knew some promoters, and I wanted to go out and do music and figure out how to have a music career. I just had no idea where to start with that. And ultimately, I ended up living at a venue that's still a venue today, the Market Hotel. Hmm. I lived there above Mr. Kiwi's, and it was a really great place. I mean, there was a lot of cool people living around there. Around the corner was the Wallet, where a couple friends of mine, Andy and Edwin from the band Tone Starts Bandit, mm-hmm. great Canadian band, they among many,
thank
legendary
you.
Band.
Thank you for the shout out for my country. I appreciate that. Thank you. That's very nice.
Yeah, no problem. There will be a lot of Canada compliments in this. In this interview, so
we here in Canada, the radio, the broadcasting and radio regulations people, they refer to it as Canadian content is CanCon. So already we've struck upon some CanCon during this conversation. It's Con. It's Canadian Content Conversation. It's Con. It's almost, yeah. It sounds like a dance you would do. So that's nice. That's very
do
nice.
Do the Con.
Con. Yeah. So, by the way, before we go too much further, you mentioned something called Mr. Kiwis. That sounds intriguing. That sounds festive. It sounds sweet. Maybe a little bitter. What was Mr. Kiwis?
Well, you know, it was all of those things combined. It was a fantastic Bushwick oasis on Myrtle Broadway that just happened to be downstairs. Their doors have always been open. They will always be open. And the reason why is because they have no doors.
Oh.
Yeah.
Is it a venue?
No, it's a bodega.
Oh,
it's
I'm sorry.
It's a bodega. Okay. With like, it's a Korean-owned bodega that this family has had, I don't know how long, but it seems like forever, and they just had really good produce, really great juice man, and a lot of really good vegan snacks and, you know, mochi and good stuff. It was great that it was right beneath my house.
So this term, by the way, and I don't mean to go off on too much of a tangent here, bodega seems to be pervading the lexicon, the common usage of bodega. Because here in Canada, we have convenience stores that serve the same purpose. Maybe you would say a smaller, some of them, like I get the bodega's got the groceries, right? It's not just your cigarettes and your soda pop. It's got all sorts of different things. But bodegas. Do you have bodegas in California? Do all Americans refer to like the little corner store as a bodega, or is there a distinction that you're aware of?
As far as I know, bodegas do not naturally exist in Southern California.
I see.
I always thought bodega was more of an East Coast term for corner store / deli / grocery / liquor. Like you could just go and to the bodega, get a sandwich, get a beer, buy some loose cigarettes or whatever.
It's like is it a New York thing? Like you're saying, so it's not American. In California, you don't. If you said to someone in California, "I'm going to the bodega," they'd say, "What time's your flight?" Like they wouldn't know what you were talking about. Is that what you're saying?
They'd know what I was talking about, but they'd kind of be like, "Huh?" They would maybe stop and be like, why would you call it that? I think that it if there are bodegas, it's like a term of a symptom of gentrification.
Ah, yes, there you go.
Because there's been such, in the last 5 to 10 years, such a huge influx of people fleeing the East Coast and the cold and the city and moving, you know, comfortably into, nestling into, you know, the northeast region of Los Angeles. There's been more of that kind of stuff popping up because of the familiarity.
Right.
It's like being back home or something.
Okay, so you end up in New York. I mean, were people in California like, why would you live in New York? The weather, the popular, you know, because it feels, anyway, I've admitted this on the show a few times before. I've never actually been to California somehow. I've traveled around a lot of America, but somehow just haven't made it all the way to California. And I like aspects of California, and I want to, well, I don't know if I'll ever get to now, but I wanted to visit it. I've wanted to visit it for some time. But New York I know kind of well because I've been there many times with touring with bands or traveling and whatnot. So I like New York, but I have like New York pride, even though I'm not a New Yorker. It's like East Coast pride in the hardiness, the cold, the weather, the kind of being stifled by all the humanity. But is California a bit more spread out? It's a little more chill. That's the perception anyway. But I don't think there's actually, is it less people or does it just feel like less population density? You know what I mean? Did you feel more claustrophobic in New York as in comparison to California?
I did, but I also appreciate the sense of anonymity in New York. I think that's one of the coolest things about it is that you can just walk in a sea of people and it feels really, I like very densely populated places. Like I love when people are all packed. I mean, I play shows for a living, so My dopamine receptors are, they get released when I see lots of people packed into a space, because that means that it's going to be a good show, you know?
Right.
So I think that it kind of calms me down. When I was living there, I would always take the train. It sounds so cheesy, but I just love touristy places. I would just go to Times Square and hang out in Times Square.
Oh.
And, you know, kind of go to all the naughty places that nobody in New York really wants to go. The funny thing was, nobody in California, because nothing was happening in Los Angeles. That's the reason I moved, was because there was no scene. At the time, there had just been a huge wave of bands that had kind of crested. That was like me growing up in Los Angeles and in Los Angeles County and going to shows at The Smell, you know, seeing No Age and Health and Liars and Mika Miko and like all of these super LA, you know, really great bands and a really great scene. Yeah. An all-ages DIY scene that I still think is, you know, I'm so glad that that was able to happen. And I hope that it can happen again, but it's the world's a very different place now.
Well, yes.
Especially after the Ghost Ship fire.
Oh, yeah, there's that too, yeah. Did that have a... I mean, we all heard about that, and it was an absolute tragedy. Did that have a massive ripple effect on how the music community sort of behaved after that? Did it really put a damper on people even wanting to do stuff?
I think that it just gave the green light to Vice, and like Vice being police, to just raid spaces,
right,
find, you know, illegal stuff, bring the fire marshal in. Everybody started to close. Everybody got the fire marshal called. Like, all the great LA DIY spaces just were erased. It was gone. They were gone.
Yeah, they look for those opportunities to shut down underground or DIY spaces. I just moved relatively recently anyway. It's been about a year and a bit now, but I used to live in Ontario, relatively close to Toronto, and Toronto is just every couple of... Well, since the pandemic, it's even gone up more, but we used to get reports of venues, DIY venues in particular, being shut down. And that was running rampant, or the buildings that the rooms were in were being destroyed, and condominiums were going up, or some form of gentrification was occurring, and so that seems to be running rampant across this continent anyway. Based on what you're saying, there's just not anywhere to play if you're coming up, it sounds like, where you're at right now. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that the wave of gentrification really pushed all the DIY spaces away from the cities, away from the more densely populated regions of Los Angeles, where public transportation makes it, you know, easy to get around.
Yeah.
And put more emphasis on, you know, the Live Nation-owned venues and, like, the corporate-run venues who are, like, mostly 18 and up or 21 and up. And, The Smell is still a thing, you know. The Smell still exists,
yeah,
which is so amazing that they've been dodging eviction for years, and it seemed like it was going to be over, you know, probably like 4 years ago. We were like, oh, this is like the end, but they've made it through, and I think that's great, because it's just so great to have a space that is all ages, has no alcohol, is just about seeing music and like having a scene.
Yeah. That sounds ideal. That's my, as the kids say, that's my jam right there, what you're talking about, you know? As a non-drinker, I just want to go see the music and, you know, not have to deal with the bar as a promoter or whatever. You know, that was always when you'd put on shows at bars, you'd have to make sure the bar was happy, you know, make sure the bar was selling their booze. You know, and for me, it was just like I had to care about that on the one hand, but I also did not give a shit. I just wanted to get my friends or the bands I like to, you know, have a nice show. And so what you're describing is ideal. And you mentioned that you're a touring musician. There's not really a great need for you to have a home base in that regard, or there wasn't until this lockdown. I assume you have been pretty locked down since the pandemic began. You've been staying put. Is that fair?
95%.
Oh, okay.
I've made a couple COVID-safe trips, but other than camping and doing stuff like that, I have been 100% locked down.
Right. So as someone who keeps themselves as mobile as possible for work, how has this past year and a bit been for you? Are there any bright spots, or has it all been what the hell is going on? Like, how would you characterize this? What's it been now? 13 months as we're speaking? 14 months almost?
Right.
How would you characterize it?
Well, I mean, when lockdown happened, I had just flown back from Mexico City, where Wand played our last show pre-pandemic at Normal Festival, and just, you know, had a whirlwind, like 4 days of pretty extreme partying in Mexico City that was really fun, and just, you know, eating whatever we want. I ate whatever I wanted and just had, you know, a lot of really good Oaxacan food, like traditional Oaxacan food.
Uh-huh,
and
uh-huh.
And then came home and I was like, oh, this is lockdown? Okay, this is fine. I don't really want to go anywhere. I think I've been touring at least half the year for the last almost 8 years.
Yeah.
And so it's made me realize a lot of different things about my personality that require raw time, that can't have my life subdivided by, you know, touring schedules and recording schedules and writing schedules and interview schedules and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's almost like I've gotten to get reacquainted with parts of myself that I haven't really known since I was like a kid in college, you know, or in art school.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where I really didn't have anything going on and I was just trying to figure my shit out. And that part has been really great, especially creatively. It, you know, it sucks not being able to tour, but when you tour at that frequency, it's hard to really make sense of what's happening in terms of quality. Like, is the quality of all these decisions like pretty uniform? You know, do we really need to do this second leg of this tour where we hit all these cities again? Yeah. Or, you know, should we just really try to make an impact when we feel impactful? You
right.
know what I mean? It's
yeah.
Like, it's like that.
Yeah. I've been contemplating the life of a touring musician a little bit in relation to all of this lockdown and the lack of, you know, live shows. Because in a weird way, in my memories of being a touring person, like you're moving around the country, whatever country you're in, you're moving, but you're kind of still because you're sitting in a van and or a car, whatever it is, a bus. Mm-hmm. If you're lucky, it's a bus. But you're just sitting there in motion, not really being able to do anything. Lots of time to think and maybe catch up on things in theory if you can, you know, calibrate your brain and your body to not be so exhausted from what you're doing. You can actually finish things in theory. And then mm-hmm. in the evening, by early evening, all the manic activity begins, the sound checking, the playing, all that stuff. And then you do it every day. So there's this weird cycle of what I would describe a kind of movement but stillness and then just manic activity and then again and again and again. So I was just trying to figure out, I was thinking about it, like, is there any way a touring musician used to all that time to themselves might be better suited for this time of isolation that we're going through? Like, you're not doing you're not doing the touring, you're not moving anywhere, so there's that monotony, but at the same time, there's a little bit of built-in monotony to touring life, isn't there?
Oh, there's a huge amount of monotony. It is entirely the same. And there is nobody, no group of working people that I can think of, no workforce better equipped to just kill time. Fill, if there was a gun that you could fill with time, they would just shoot it into the sky. Like that's what we do. We just like have and really just kill time in ways that are meditative in a way.
Yeah.
I almost think because most of the time that I'm killing time, I'm just staring out the window. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting occupation, mostly because of the way that it's perceived as being very exotic and adventurous and like travel intensive and also romantic.
Yeah.
And then they forget how much of it is dictated by driving schedules, bowel movements,
yeah.
sleeping schedules.
Yeah. Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's all very bodily and like fluid oriented.
It is. It is absolutely. So I guess you're saying you kind of would agree on the one hand that you might be pretty well suited to deal with this stillness that we're all going through.
Oh yeah, I can kill time like nobody else. I can just sit and stare at the sky.
Yeah.
It's like my friend Kyle Thomas, King Tuff. He plays in.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Or he is King Tuff.
Yeah.
I'll call him and be like, Kyle, what have you been doing? And he just says, just staring at the sky.
Which on the one hand, kind of nice. Kind of nice to be able to have the time to stare at the sky and not have to worry about anything, I guess. But
I need that time.
Yeah, but then the flip side is, as creative people, you want to be constantly making things. So have you been able to do work? Have you been able to write or make music by yourself or with anyone, I don't know, remotely or in a socially distanced, safe way since the lockdown began? Have you been busy in that regard?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've been busy. Yeah, a lot of stuff going on now. It kind of was very slow for about 8 months of the pandemic. And then around the fall time when Pale Horse Rider got announced I guess that was the winter time.
Yeah.
A little bit before then, that's when things really picked up. Mm-hmm. And it's been really nice to have the time to devote to just making whatever. Because when I'm home, when I have time at home, I just work on music every day.
Yeah.
Without really trying to directly focus on, certain things certain projects until they become well shaped and formed and then can be, executed or edited or whatever.
Yeah.
But when I'm just putting my feelers out, using intuition and trying different things, trying new things and exploring stuff, it's so great to have just raw time to do that.
Yeah.
And only that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I want to tell you that I really, really love Pale Horse Rider. Wonderful record. And I wonder when you made it exactly. Did you make it? Or I assume you might have done some. Well, no, I'm not going to assume anything. When did you make this record exactly? Can you speak to that?
I recorded it in December of 2019.
Ah, okay. Just ahead of the stillness and the lockdown.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So the songs that we are hearing are not informed by any of the experience you've had or we've had since then. And I also want to point out, so this is your second solo album, I believe, yes?
Yep.
Yes. Yeah, so if it wasn't the pandemic that was separating you from your friends in Wand, what clicks the switch for you to think, I got to make a solo record now? I'm not going to make a record with the band. Do you have a sense of that? Like, why did you want to pursue the work that we now have in our possession with Pale Horse Rider on your own, under your own name?
Well, I always wanted to make my own records. I wanted to, even after Unborn Capitalist from Limbo, I immediately started working on a follow-up, but it did get kind of swallowed into the sort of force that Wand became in my life. And
yeah.
In terms of a writing, five-person writing unit, I think that was just a really exciting discovery that we could all, because we had been touring so much and cutting our teeth and stuff, we just, started to not have to talk as much about what we were doing and just play and listen to each other. And that was sort of how Laughing Matter came about, was just doing that for months, playing, yeah, jamming. And so I started to feel really comfortable, because when you're in a five-person unit, you can... You don't have to really address your weaknesses. You can really lean into your strengths. And my strengths are, you know, guitar, writing, arranging, editing, and splitting lyrical duties with Evan Burrows, the drummer in Wand.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we could both, because he's a really amazing writer, and so we could bounce ideas off of each other. And then... after, like, overkill touring on that record, I think we were all so burned out. We were out for, like, 8 months.
Yeah.
And it was too much, and the band needed a break. So 2020, coincidentally, was the year that Wand took off from touring.
Oh, you were going to be off anyway. I see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, if luck should have it, we didn't have to cancel a single show.
Right. Okay, so you knew that by December of 2019, that you're going to have a year kind of to yourself, so to speak, or you thought you were going to have a year to yourself. So did you say you finished recording in December of 2019?
Yeah.
Right, so it was done? Wow, okay, interesting. It's funny, you know, we're not hearing it until 2021, obviously. Just checking.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it takes a while to get things done. Did you have a particular approach in mind for Pale Horse Rider as it related to your previous solo record or even stuff you were doing in Wand? Was there something you wanted to try to explore that you hadn't yet, or potentially even fine-tune based on stuff you've made before?
I mean, I gave myself a lot of time, you know, in between Unborn Capitalist and Pale Horse Rider to figure out some kind of internal conflicts I was having about the idea of just being a songwriter in general and what that meant to me and what I bring to that tradition.
Yeah.
And I think that with Unborn Capitalist, the reason that record got made is because we had made those first three Wand records, which are pretty heavy and fuzzy and loud. And we were touring, you know, with these huge stacks of amps, and it was just so loud, and it was such a spectacle, like sonic spectacle,
yeah,
that I started to feel really disoriented. Like, I couldn't tell if people were enjoying the songs or if it was more about just the sonic thing that was happening, because that was also a big thing at that time, was just having a billion amps on stage and making something super loud and, yeah, heavy.
Yeah.
So that record, I just was like, what do I do? Like, what is my melodic sensibility? Like, what resonates with me musically? And then it just, you know, turned into this acoustic kind of folky record. With Pale Horse Rider, it's kind of the same thing. I was playing, you know, with Juan in this five-piece configuration for so, yeah, long. I started to think, well, how, like, can I even make records by myself anymore? Can I address these parts of myself that I haven't been addressing for a long time? Or will it just seem like a fragment? I'm not looking to make like a David Gilmour solo record. I want to make like a Phil Collins solo record, if you know what I mean. I want to feel like my own planet.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah.
So it was kind of like that. I don't know. It took a long time, and it kind of took me coming back to country music and thinking about country music as a framework, or like country western music as a framework for how to approach this record.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, and I'm sorry to cut you off when you were about to talk about the lyrics, because I do want to talk about that too. Sorry. Two things I want to say. But let's get to the lyrics now, because you're talking about reflecting upon your process and the way you work and why you work the way you work. I hear that, and that's reflected in the sound of this particular record. But lyrically, are you also reflecting upon something in particular, something about you and your past, about California, I mean, and also, like, within that, there's lots of very understated humor in what you're saying, I find. And very, like, fun with language. Even just stretching out psychoanalyst. You know, I heard your phrasing there, and I was like, that just sounds like fun. Just to say psychoanalyst in this weird way. And then you rhyme it with, you talk about how your car got egged by the psychoanalyst and now they're your nemesis. That's funny. Like, I chuckle when I hear that. Is that meant? Am I wrong to chuckle? Am I laughing at a funeral? Should I not be doing this?
No, you could do whatever you want, man.
Okay, just making sure. Just making sure. But all this to say, are you reflecting? Let's get to the lyrics then. Do you feel like overall you're kind of reflecting upon a time in your life as well, or anything in particular?
Not any more than I have with my other records. But I will say about the lyrics, I wanted to shift my focus away from arrangements and stuff like that and chord progressions and sonics and just let the lyrics kind of dictate those things.
Right.
Dictate the space and the, you know, musical arrangement and stuff like that. And to do that, I sort of had to figure out how to, like I said, like what my songwriter identity was. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing from my writing that has always had a hard time being articulated is my sense of humor.
Yeah.
Which is very much a part of, I'd say, probably more developed than any other part of me, even musically, you know, just from being a kid and like having no interest in music, but having an interest in being funny or sharing jokes with people or laughing and stuff, being a class clown, which I was.
Yeah.
That just came out of having to really like figure out what my instincts were with writing, which I've never really been able to sit down and do and just write every single day for long periods of time. And just sort of like writing can be such a chore when it's forced.
Yeah.
It can be really like pulling teeth when you don't really have a sense of, it's like doing anything else. When your baseline is weak, or not weak, but just like, you know, it's like bowling. If you don't bowl, you go and bowl and it's fun, but you're going to like maybe get a strike and be like, how did I do that? And then you're going to bowl again and it's going to be gutter ball, gutter ball, gutter ball, gutter ball. And you're going to, you, the strike doesn't even matter at that point. So, but if you go bowl every day, then your baseline will be raised and all of a sudden you're getting, you know, mostly strikes. And that's sort of what I wanted. That is what I wanted.
Yeah.
I wanted to only get strikes.
Did somebody send you video of me bowling by chance? Because you're describing me to a T. I don't know how to bowl. No one's ever taught me to bowl. But every time I go bowling, I get a bunch of strikes. But then I also will screw up. And then I'm like, yeah, that checks out. I don't know what I'm doing. Why am I doing well? I shouldn't be doing well. I don't know how to do this. Then I do well. And then, as I say, then I don't do well. And I'm like, yeah, that seems more like it. So I feel like maybe you're spying on me. Have we bowled together or something? Like you're describing me to a T somehow. But I think you're right about skill sets sort of being within and without, beyond and within your control. I think that's kind of what you're maybe talking about a little bit.
It's easy to take the gutter balls personally if you've gotten a strike, you know?
Yes, it's true.
Because then you're like, why am I getting gutters? I just got a strike. I just showed everybody here that I'm good at this, and now I'm humiliating myself. And the humiliation is worse because I did well before.
Well, bowling's weird. I just saw a pretty funny tweet by someone that said, you should be able to play defense in bowling. And I think that's funny. You should have to deke around someone, dodge, you know, you got to dodge someone to even get that approach shot. Because to your point, I think there's a lot of luck involved in most sports, frankly, you know, when they're like, oh my God, did you see that basket that person hit at the last second? It bounced, it hit the net, it hit the rim like 18 times and then went in. Yeah, you're kind of underselling at that point. That's just luck and gravity, really. Like it seems to me if it hit 18 times, that's not skill. And so when I go casual bowling like once or twice a year and I do well, I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. Do I have to join a league now? Is my life permanently altered? I didn't want to be good at this. I just went for fun. So I'm not saying I'm Mr. Perfect here. I screw things up, but I'm just saying there's a lot of luck in our skill somehow, don't you think? Like in our ability to get, it's like when you do a take of a song and maybe it's your second time through after having some long discussion about it amongst yourselves, and then you're like, yeah, that was it. We don't have to do that again. Like, it's perfect. I don't know why. Just there was that moment in time, perfect. You must have that experience, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think that you're just tapping into a wavelength that is crucial to bowling well. Whatever you're doing, however your brain works, like you might just have a more developed, you know, like alpha sensitivity or something. Like you're getting right into that alpha zone.
Yeah.
And that's where you need to be, you know, where time kind of slows down and you can appreciate the sights and smells of the alley. You know you're there just for fun. It doesn't matter if you perform well.
Yeah.
You know, like that kind of stuff. I think that always that's the headspace you want to be, and it's easier to get into that deep focus when you raise your baseline to, you know, when you just do that every day. Sometimes it's also to the detriment because you become so focused on performing well that you lose sight of all the good stuff, which makes it enjoyable to begin with. And that happens in the studio a lot.
Well, I think we really value and appreciate the flukes in our life, you know, the things that you don't do as much that you do okay at, that come to you easily. And then the thing you spend, I find that all the time. I'll put a lot of effort into one thing, and the thing I put the least amount of effort into is the thing that, if it's a public thing, that's the thing that resonates. I always find that. I spend, you know, weeks and weeks preparing something, and then something I do off the cuff does well. And you're like, well, what? Like, in terms of, you know, whatever, response. You're like, I don't know. What am I doing? I go, what is the right answer here? You know, if what is the measure of success? Like, do I want to be fulfilled from weeks and weeks of work, or is the thing I spent 1 minute thinking about that everyone's excited about, like, is that what I should be doing? You know, like, it's confusing to make things in the public sphere, don't you find?
Oh, yeah. I will say this. I think that watching and listening to audiences and getting feedback on records or whatever, it's all people tend to marvel or just they tend to have a peak interest when a performer or a public figure or somebody does something and makes it look incredibly like it's nothing.
Yeah.
Like they're just, it's the easiest thing to them. And so whatever thing that you did that was off the cuff, you know, it's going to have less baggage than something that you labored over. And I've done, you know, I've noticed this like approaching promoting records where if I talk about like, man, that record was so hard and it took months and we had to remix it like this many times and like I was freaking out about every little nuance of, you know, guitar noise that was coming off of my pickups and had to, you know, do all this stuff. Like that kind of neuroses only works for a couple bands, you know, like Steely Dan
or
Radiohead.
Bands where
the whole story is about it was hard and it was terrible and, you know. But for most people, I feel like people tend to like it when things are pretty easy and fun.
Well, that's true. It's a little bit of emotional manipulation even. Oh, this was so hard. I hope you appreciate it. I hope you appreciate the work we put into this because it wasn't easy. Oh, okay. I'll give it a really close listen then. You know, as opposed to the person's like, I spent 3 hours making that album. Here you go. Well, I mean, clearly this sounds like 3 hours. Yeah, it's weird how we color, you know, the stuff we make to people outside of that experience, you know? Like that's... You know, I guess we're getting into sort of marketing promotion and what works and what doesn't work a little bit, which is what it is on some level. I mean, I mentioned a couple of lyrics from the song Angelus that stuck out for me as being funny, even though the song doesn't have the pacing of something that is like a laugh riot. There's this humor there. Are there any other instances on the record where you're like, ha, 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 I'm kind of happy with how that turned out. That's kind of fun. You know, is there anything else that you want to highlight? I'm just curious.
I think there's a lot of little moments of that. There's a lot of imagery in the record that just pops straight out of my head. I don't really know why or how that works, but yeah, like off the top of my head, humorous moments on Pale Horse Rider.
Don't mean to put you on the spot. Like, even the title track is a nice, it's not a double entendre, but it has a double meaning, because I'm like, oh, it's someone riding a white horse. No, it's a white person riding a horse. Like, there's just like a little fun with language there, you know, and I appreciate stuff like that.
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, I definitely have a knack for, or an interest in wordplay, and I like things that are kind of low brow or mid brow. And puns are one of those things where I always say this to people, because I always do very stupid puns, and I always tell people, like, oh yeah, the pun is the lowest form of humor.
Oh, I love puns. Puns are my favorite. I love puns. I like doing them. They're fun.
Yeah, and I think that they're just a great way to dislocate different meaning, like make recombinant meanings that can take certain things that, and they're glued together by humor or absurdity or double meanings or things, and you can kind of think, you can kind of spin the word around, each word individually, and look at them from different places that you wouldn't normally be able to, or different contexts.
Yeah, like we were talking about bowling earlier, and you have a song called Vegas Knights, and Knights is spelled like a knight, like a knight in shining armor. And I was like, yeah. Oh, are you a hockey person? Do you like hockey?
You know, I'm sorry, but I don't watch hockey.
No, you don't really watch. I don't like hockey. I play it sometimes. I don't like watching it, but I believe, and I'm not up on, there's lots of expansion teams. Isn't the NHL team from Vegas called the Las Vegas Knights?
The Golden Knights.
Oh, is it the Golden Knights? Oh, okay. But are they from Las Vegas?
Yes.
So it's Vegas Knights. I'm not totally wrong here. It has nothing to do with this, does it? This song has nothing to do with sticks and pucks and ice, is what you're saying.
No, I wouldn't rule that out.
Okay.
I just won't say that it is about that.
Okay, fair enough. This is not meant to be an investigation per se. You know, you don't need a lawyer present to answer any of these questions. That's fair. Totally fair. What I was going to say, sorry, were you going to finish your thought there? I didn't mean to cut you off with the hockey talk.
Oh, no, no. Please.
Okay. Just
bring on the hockey talk. I'm a hockey talk woman.
Yeah. So. It's more of a CanCon, more Canadian content with the hockey.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things I was going to ask you about earlier was the sound of this particular record, and you'd invoked country and Western music. And I wonder if you have a relationship or an affinity for music by, I don't know, The Byrds or, you know, late 60s Bob Dylan. Because on the song Pale Horse Rider, there's kind of a pre-chorus part. And every time I hear it, I think, oh, that's You Ain't Going Nowhere by Bob Dylan. But then I listen to it again, I think, no, wait, that's You Ain't Going Nowhere by The Byrds. It's a little different. Do you have any connection to any of the people I just mentioned, or even the songs I just mentioned?
Oh, of course. I mean, those records are huge for me.
Sweetheart of the Rodeo, these kinds of things.
Sweetheart of the Rodeo, yeah. You Ain't Going Nowhere. That whole record, I mean, it's just and Graham Parsons, the Grievous Angel, and his first record as well. Yeah, those records are real big for me. And I think I was definitely listening to Grievous Angel while working on the record and just thinking about his story. We recorded the record in Joshua Tree.
Oh, nice. Yeah, that's right.
Not far away from where he, you know, passed away from heroin. So the record does have for me that kind of like desert romance. The Vegas Knights fits into that too, because I'm a huge fan of Vegas. I really love the image of just this empty black space with these mountains that kind of, you know, turn into this little valley that is just this beam of golden light.
Yeah.
You know, that just shoots off in all directions but ultimately just turns into darkness on all sides. I really love that image. And so Yeah, there's a lot of desert romance going on in this record.
Right, and that's informed as that informs the sound of it as much as maybe your approach to even singing. Like some of it, I was trying to put my finger on it a little bit about where you're coming from with this in relation to Wand, and I feel like that what we're both kind of getting at, the references we're making, I think that's definitely, by the sounds of it, you're confirming that. That's present on this record for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, just making sure. Again, no lawyer needed. These are meant to be benign questions, just gentle, gentle questions. So, well, it is a gorgeous record. As I say, I love it. What do you do? You made a record. It's going to come out. It's been delayed. Its release date was delayed due to various things, I think. Or do you want to speak to that? I know there's been some vinyl pressing plant issues, among other things. Is there any other reason why the record's been pushed back a little bit?
Yeah, it just felt like it needed a little more time, you know? No, I didn't push it back.
Okay.
Personally. But I didn't have a hand in that, but it is what it is, ultimately, releasing a record in the days of COVID-19.
Yeah.
The hopefully, you know, the dusk of COVID-19 right now.
Yeah.
We'll see. But yeah, it just, there was some production delays that were all interlinked, you know, one affected the other. One plant got COVID and that caused the other plant to stop production and et cetera.
Yeah. Okay. So it's sort of a business oriented situation, and hopefully everyone is okay and work can be done safely, of course. And the look of the album, like the cover art, fascinates me because on the one hand you have this, I guess it's like a gold sort of, is it gold? Is it meant to be gold? That sort of background image?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it kind of like Watch the Throne. And then in the middle, just like a house scene, like someone on a porch or something. I can't tell. It's a bit tiny on my screen here. But what's going on the cover of this record?
Well, the cover is a photo of me coming out of the, like standing in the doorway of the house where we recorded the record. And then it's framed by this gold foil.
Yes.
That my friend Justin Gallego put together. He laid out and did the art for that record. And the photo was shot by Zach Hernandez, who engineered the record.
Is there a suitcase in the foreground?
A suitcase? I don't think so. I think it's just the patio in Landers, California. This house, my friend Brian's house, which he calls Cactopia,
yes,
because it's full of these massive psychotropic cacti.
Oh, okay.
That are, you know, like 7 or 8 feet tall, have a lot of personality.
I'm telling you, there's something in the foreground here. I've asked my computer to enhance the image, and there's something at the foot of the walkway. And if I were to make an educated guess, as I have earlier, it would be a suitcase. It seems to be an arrival or a departure. Maybe it's something else, but maybe it's just a shadow, actually. Oh, my goodness. I'm getting kind of X-Files on you with the cover art, and I'm sorry. I didn't mean to suggest any kind of conspiracies at play, but it's a striking image, particularly with the gold around it. What does all this say to you? If you could interpret this, what do you think is going on the cover of your own album?
Oh, well, I wanted, because of the Vegas theme, my idea was just like, oh, just make it look like a casino. Give it a casino vibe, but maybe like a dilapidated casino that's falling apart and is haunted and stuff like that. And so I like the gold foil, that print of the gold, that scan of gold foil, because it's like its gaudiness is not really present because of the like texture, you know. It's not.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem desirable to me. But it's very textural and rich in texture and stuff.
So does Las Vegas as a motif live within the record beyond the song Vegas Nights?
Yeah. I think there's a lot of ambient sound in that record. I think that there's some slot machines in there somewhere.
Oh, okay.
Oh, in Paper Fog in the left channel.
Oh, you panned it.
There's a part with some slot machines. You can hear some coins falling.
Are you also a fan of the Neil Young album Tonight's the Night at all?
Oh my God, huge fan.
Because there's a song it reminds me in sort of the feel. There's a song where the guitar just explodes. It's an extended guitar jam thing.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And it reminded me, at least sort of rhythmically or the pace of it, reminded me a bit of Albuquerque by Neil Young. And anyway, I feel like some things are maybe more overt than others, but it's gratifying to me to hear that you are a fan of that. Did that record inform any of your decision making here, Tonight's the Night?
Absolutely, I think.
Oh, there you go.
I mean,
okay.
That's a huge... Yeah. That's a huge record for me. I think that the idea of assuming a character the way that Neil does on that record, and yeah. he in order to address, you know, all these deeply personal,
yeah,
this grief that he's going through with his former bandmate passing away and his roadie passing away, he just embodies this, you know, darkness and kind of uses that as a way to remove himself from that feeling, from that grief, but also address it in the music.
Mm.
So it's like a deeply personal record, but it's also not, you know?
Yeah, it's a narrative in a way. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's very antagonistic and a response to his Harvest success and stuff.
So, okay. So that, just the attitude, even the stance of that record kind of inspired you in aspects of how you wanted to convey thoughts, ideas, sounds on Pale Horse Rider. Is that fair?
Yeah, it was definitely an influence. I think him and Bob Dylan also, the Rolling Thunder Review Bob Dylan, and just like his kind of antagonism. I think that I love it when these big artists have a tremendous sense of humor and can kind of poke fun at their own mythology.
Oh my God, that Rolling Thunder Review thing that Dylan and Scorsese made is one of the greatest things I've ever seen. They're just both having so much fun, making fun of us, the Dylan people, who think everything has meaning and there's all this weirdness, and just making fake stories up about that. I mean, the live footage on that thing is unbelievable. And the sense of humor there as well. Like, it's pure, it's meant, it's sort of good humored intensity, you know, the staring, the looking. I know he's sort of having a laugh, even though it's menacing. Like, it's, yeah, sorry, I don't mean to go on a Dylan. I love Bob Dylan, so I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think I really value that approach. I think Neil probably more than Dylan, because I think Dylan lacks the kind of self-awareness that Neil Young has in terms of being able, Dylan is able to make fun of everybody, but he's not really able to make fun of himself, and Neil can.
I must object, Your Honor. I now we're back to the legalese. I think from the earliest points, when he realized what the media was and what they wanted him to be, can you imagine being, you know, in your early 20s and all your press conferences are like, what are you saying? This is great. Like, what do you mean by this? Like, do you think you're the spokesman of a generation? You've seen that very famous press conference he did in San Francisco.
Oh, yeah.
Where he's
Absolutely.
Just like taking the piss. And like, I think from that point on, he had no use for speaking too self-seriously. But he does. I would agree that he carries himself with a certain self-serious, like, don't fuck with me. Like, you can't look at me, you can't talk to me, that kind of stuff. And that's a little silly, but I think he's protecting himself after just decades and decades of people wanting stuff from him and, you know, any little piece of him that they can go and tell everyone about. Anyway, my point is, I think he is actually quite self-aware. He maybe goes through phases where the self-seriousness is unintentionally comical or the earnestness. But and then Neil's the same. Like, Neil's prickly, a lot of jokes. I talked to Jim Jarmusch a few months ago on the occasion of Neil Young's birthday, and he told me this amazing story about they went to Cannes to promote Dead Man, and when they got there, it was Neil and Jim and whoever else, And the people there said, do you want to do some press? Do you want to talk to the media? And Jim said, ah, oh, I hate talking about my movies. But if I have to, I will. And they said, Neil, you want to go? You want to do it? And he went, no, I don't want to speak. I don't want to talk to anyone. But I want to attend every one of Jim's interviews. And they were like, why? He's like, well, if anyone's wasting Jim's time, I want to tell them about it. So Jim tells me, like, it's Janet Maslin, all these, like, movie critics from the Newsweek, and all the big newspapers are coming in. They're asking. So it's just Neil Young saying nothing and Jim Jarmusch sitting there. And so they're told, just talk to Jim. And so the questions come. And then every once in a while, Neil will lean forward and say, you're really wasting Jim's time with that one. Like, that's just funny. He's just a funny guy.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think he's funny. I think they're both funny. If I might say. Sorry, I didn't mean to undercut what you're saying. Does that resonate with you? Do you think I'm out to lunch?
No, for sure. I think Dylan is very funny, and I think that in a lot of ways he is always messing with his own mythology.
Yeah.
And always kind of part of it, I think, is intense, like, self-preservation, you know, just trying to have some semblance of a life, like a normal life. And then the other part, I think he is deeply invested in. I mean, I think there's three parts. That one is trying to keep his personal life sacred. Second is trying to fuck with everybody who thinks that he walks on water or
yeah.
whatever. And then the third, I think, is him actually just buying into his own mythology.
Yeah.
It's sort of like Tom Waits or something.
Yeah.
Where, you know, like all these people where they do kind of believe their own bullshit.
Well,
to a degree.
At the same time, I'm sure he's like whatever about most stuff, but you get a Nobel Prize, Presidential Medal of Freedom, Oscar Award, Grammy Awards. Like, at some point, you're like, all right, I get it. You guys like me. Like, I appreciate that what I'm doing, you know, resonates, but I'm just a song and dance man, you know? Like, I just make my music, I play. Anyway, this is a whole other kind of tangent, but I feel like these figures, Bob, Neil, Roger McGuinn, Graham Parsons, you know, the birds. I feel like they're all swimming around on this beautiful record. And as such, it really resonated with me for what that's worth.
Yeah, I mean, I was listening to a lot of late era Dylan, like now era Dylan. I was listening to The Tempest.
Oh, man, that's an angry one.
Some rough stuff, you know, like some. I mean, it's challenging music, I think. In a way.
That's like, I think tellingly, that's the most bitter, and like maybe since Blood on the Tracks, just a really bitter, angry album at us, just angry at everything. And then tellingly, he takes a break to make the kind of Sinatra era records. Like, he's like, I can't do this. He kind of exercised something, I think, and then decided to spend, you know, 3-4 records just singing other people's sort of film noir-y kind of songs, I think of them as. Like, dark in their own way, but not as biting. And then I thought Rough and Rowdy Ways was a nice middle ground between the two. There's the bite of Tempest, but the kind of more romantic. I guess it's still biting, but it's just a little more romanticized stuff going on that might have been spawned from those Sinatra songs he was doing. Well, we're getting into Dylan scholarship here, and I hope you don't feel like this is a waste of time, but I think about him and his stuff a lot, and I spend a lot of time with the records. Is this coming through to you? Do you feel like I maybe have a problem, a Bob Dylan problem?
I mean, I think I have a Bob Dylan problem. So, you know?
Well,
he haunts the spirit of every wandering white middle class songwriter.
Yeah.
You know, who is trying to, you know, who's in their late 20s, early 30s, trying to make something of themselves and also like make sense of the musical landscape of what's happening, what is right now. And I think that the further you get from the 60s Dylan, like the mid 60s Dylan, like the whatever, his golden period, which I would argue is his worst period.
My favorite records are Time Out of Mind and Love and Theft, frankly.
Wow, okay.
So when people ask me about my favorite, and then it's like John Wesley Harding. I appreciate mm-hmm. the ambition of all that other, the stuff that preceded, you know, that mid-60s period you're talking about. And it's like now that, you know, once they start doling out more Rolling Thunder stuff or you find it yourself, you're like, holy shit, this was the greatest live sound he ever had on some level. Like, what a crazy sound that was. Because we made such yeah. a big deal about the 66 sound with the members of the band. But then right. you get to the Rolling Thunder, you're like, no, that's a crazy sound. Like, that's a punk rock sound. Like, that is weird. And then, yeah, but I've seen him like 70 times since 1998 or something. And
really?
Yeah, I like him. I think if you have Bob Dylan in your midst or a figure like him and you have the chance to go see him and delve into his work, you do it. And I mean, I feel like his worst periods, if you will, which everyone has their phases, but like I think the 80s were tough for him in lots of ways, mm-hmm. the way he was singing, where his focus was. But there's still some virtue in all of that stuff. Anyway, yeah, I'm kind of all in on it. Like I might have fallen for something, maybe. I mean, but I'm in. I read everything. I've written about everything. His camp knows who I am. You know, they've blurred me on the records. Like, it's weird. I have this weird connection to Bob Dylan that I've just, through some just fandom and force of will, I feel part of it. And I love him. Like, I love going to see him. I think it's always, you want to be surprised by something. Remember there was that period where everyone was like, we're going to play our album in order on tour or at the show. And I was like, why would you do that? Like, why? I've gone to some of them, and I'm like, all right, I find it distracting. Oh, yeah, they're playing this song. That means I know what the next song is. Like, it's just very out of the, I don't feel in the moment because I'm just thinking about the sequence of an archive recording, you know, whatever they did for an album. Whereas Dylan blew my, like, I'm like, this is great. I like every arrangement. Every time I see a song, it's different. And it's not because they mm-hmm. don't know what they're doing. It's because they really know what they're doing. Like, it's more complicated or whatever. It's not because they can't pull it off or something. It's like, no, the song that I recorded on that day was the song the way it was on that day. The song lives on. And every time I play it live, it can be different. That's liberating. That's great. That, to me, is punk. You know, like, so anyway, you've got me on a Bob Dylan tirade here. Does any of that make sense to you? Do you feel that?
No, yeah. Of course. I mean, I think that Bob Dylan's whole, like the way that he treats music is that he's trying to preserve something that is sacred to him about the music and that has nothing to do with the production yeah. or the instrumentation or the arrangement. It's something about him as a person. It's also something that is completely outside of him, that is just his interest and curiosity in music and people and humanity mm-hmm. and what it really means to be a part of an American tradition or like a cultural tradition of writing music for a living and being celebrated and doing that. And what I think the way that he is kind of interpreted that is like he sees it as a responsibility, like, which is why he goes and does these Sinatra records, because he's trying to preserve these songs for perhaps like what he might perceive as like a loss of quality if they are only regarded as Sinatra songs or something.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's interesting you bring it up and bring that aspect of his work up. Because speaking of people who I think are iconic and enigmatic and are also working in service of songs, you worked with Bonnie Prince Billy and Bill Callahan on one of their songs from this do we call it a cover series? How do you describe this series?
Yeah, it's a cover.
It's a cover series.
Collaborative cover thing.
I'm careful with Will. And when I say cover, I want to be careful because I had a discussion with him once that really opened my eyes to something. Because uh-huh. I asked him, you know, he'd put out one of the records he puts out every once in a while where he's doing versions of his songs, his own songs, like he mm-hmm. redoes them. And I put it to him that way. And he very, very fascinatingly was like, no, it's a whole other song. It's from a different time. It's from a different plane. It's like, what? What do you mean, Will? What are you talking about? And then he explained it to me, and now I'm into that. I'm into that idea that just because you're doing a cover of something, it's only a cover of something if you think it only exists in your own universe that you are familiar with, but it could be from another universe. Am I getting too trippy on you? I know I talked about psychedelic country music earlier. Yeah, but anyway, what song are you on? Do you remember?
Yeah, I remember. I was very honored to be invited to put together a track for Bill and Will, as a huge fan of both of them. But the song was Night Rider's Lament, popularized by Jerry Jeff Walker, who I admittedly was not that familiar with at the time of putting the track together. And since then, I've been able to listen to more. And he recently passed, which, like, right before the song was released. But, it was a interesting collaboration because they didn't give me any direction. I got no direction. I didn't even talk to them. I talked to Dan Koretsky at Drag City, who left me as much in the dark as possible.
Do you know Bill and Will at all? Like, have you met them?
I've never met them.
Oh, you've never even met them. Okay, this is a Drag City sort of invite you received.
It was a Drag City blind date collab. And I think it turned out great. I'm very, very happy with it.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. And that's very fascinating that I viewed this as a Drag City endeavor for various reasons. I mean, most of the collaborators, if not all of them, I believe, have some sort of Drag City connection. So there's that. And it seemed like a very thoughtful and yet fun way to create a little social time. Because most of this was done by social distancing protocols. Like you've never even spoken to them before in your life. You were given little direction. You created something, sent it along, and then they figured it out. Figured out how to apply the lyrics and the vocals to it. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, it's weird, but did that feel? I know you're honored. It's kind of it's a lovely gesture, isn't it? To kind of try to stretch out across the world and the country and find collaborators for a song like this. And the fact that it's a cover is both gives you structure, but it sounds like you could have done whatever you wanted. Is that right?
I did, but I didn't really want to do much. You know, I wanted it. I have a lot of equipment and stuff. I could definitely I could have treated things a lot more differently, but as a huge fan of both of their voices and their massive voices, you know.
Yeah.
I just wanted to kind of preserve that and the song and leave as much space as possible for the words and keep the arrangement really sparse.
Well,
but I think the series, you know, in talking about this, like Will's attitude or Will's thoughts about, you know, how he constructs his records where he takes on his own songs and revisits old material and then does them again. I mean, I do feel like they chose songs that could be treated that way. In some instances, I think the covers they chose and the artists that were constructing the tracks, it's almost like, what can this song withstand and still be a song?
Yeah, yeah.
And I really also like that as an idea, as in a way of approaching, you know, other people's material. Is there's, you know, the really light, you know, Sinatra or even Willie Nelson, or, you know, the way that they approach covers, which is like, just make it timeless. It's all kind of treated the same way.
Yeah.
And then this was all over the place because of the amount of artists that were taking on the material.
Yeah, just two real iconic and wise singers and songwriters really making, and all of you who collaborated, like, yeah, just totally making these songs their own fresh thing, like this OD'd in Denver that they did, or... obviously, The Wild Kindness was fantastic, and Wish You Were Gay, the Billie Eilish song, You know, my whole family loves that version of the song. We talk about it sometimes. It's really fun.
Yeah,
there's fun and humor in it as well. And anyway, I wanted to get to that too. So, Corey, this was fun. I want to ask you what's next for you. Like, do you have any possible plans at this point? Like, what is your plan for making music or playing or performing? What's going on?
Oh, I mean, I'm still waiting. I mean there's some stuff on the horizon. I don't really want to spill the beans about quite yet.
Okay.
But there's some stuff in the works. There's hopefully some touring for Pale Horse Rider in the works, and in the meantime I'm just doing what I always do, which is work on music every day and work on lyrics every day, putting my feelers out and trying to figure out what you know, giving myself the time to figure out the next move, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, you're in the same boat as a lot of people. So I just wanted to confirm that. Some people are like, well, actually, I'm doing a live streaming tour and coming to a city. People have all sorts of things. So I just wanted to check
okay.
in. Well, no, I don't know. I was kind of joking. I don't know. Do you have actually plans like that? Do you have any?
I do. We're doing a streaming series of live streams and covers that will be going live starting April 2nd and have reoccurring episodes. There will be episodes. I think there's four episodes. And it's called Limited Hangout after the track Limited mm-hmm. Hangout on my record. And it's a little wild. We kind of took the format of the live stream and did something that maybe you're not supposed to do with it. Kind of perverted it.
Oh,
It's a lot.
Everything the way you're describing it feels very Vegas. Perverted. A lot.
Yeah. So lots of lights.
Lots of lights.
We're thinking about, you know, retention. We're trying to keep the eyes on the prize, and the prize is the stream. So you get more views, you know, and you keep people from clicking out. You got to have a lot of different kinds of stuff. You have to have a variety. So you could say it's a kind of variety show.
Oh, okay. Now I'm getting a sense of where this is going, and I like it. It sounds really fun. That's great.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. Tune in.
All right, we will.
April 2nd.
I think we will. Now, the record, Pale Horse Rider, is available via Drag City, and people can learn more about that at dragcity.com. Is there anywhere else online that you'd like to direct people in terms of your presence or anything like that?
Oh, well, there's my Bandcamp, which is also through Drag City, but I think it's just Corey Hansen at Bandcamp or whatever.
Yeah. Okay. You've got your own Bandcamp. Okay. Is that it? Are you on socials? Do you do anything else?
Oh yeah, I'm on Instagram. I have an Instagram. I don't even know what my username is, but it's Corey Hansen, my name. You search that. I have a blue check now, so you should be able to figure out which one is the authentic Corey Hansen account.
Okay.
Out of the many fakes.
Okay. Sounds good. That's great. Okay. So we'll follow you on Instagram and all that stuff, and then dragcity.com and your Bandcamp. If there's a song from Pale Horse Rider that we can go out on right now, would you mind choosing one? And if so, can you tell us why you chose it?
I would say go out on Limited Hangout. I like the lyrics in that one. I'm proud of my lyrics in that one.
What is there something striking about what you've said that you can highlight for us?
Well, I wrote it using this process that was given to me as writing advice from David Berman, actually.
Oh.
And which I know you're a big fan.
Yeah, David was. That's right. David is very important to me still. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, and same with me. I'm a huge Silver Jews fan.
Yeah.
But yeah, he gave me some good advice about writing, where he just said, write 20 lines a day every day, like once a day. Just write 20 lines and don't think about what you're writing and don't force it, you know, and don't edit anything you're doing. And then take those lines at way later when you've amassed, you know, this large amount of lines, and then you can just start selecting all your favorites.
Hmm.
And then those you can sort of weave into songs. And it was really practical advice, like really simple. And this is like what we're talking with the bowling, you know, analogy, which is like, you know, raising, you know, you work out those same muscles, you do that stuff habitually, and then you start to raise your baseline for what you can achieve, and you start to learn things about, like, I just started to be able to pick up on my own instincts about writing and things that I couldn't really make sense of before.
Huh.
Of like, why is this working now? Why is this not working now? Why is this line a problem? Why do I like this line more than this line, etc.? And then more than that, it's like you just have all this, I just had all this material to problem solve with, or like to switch things out. And he said they're kind of like, he said every line is like a tweet or a meme or something. It's like, you know, you can kind of put them together, and like they, what he sort of, he says you don't do, it's not like cut up or anything. It's not novel like that.
Right.
Like, it's a way of just figuring out your own personality with writing, or
that's very,
you know, by catching yourself.
Yeah, that's interesting. Do you have to fight the compulsion as you're writing 20 lines to make them adhere to a rhyme structure or meter? Like, do you know you're possibly, you know, doing this to write a song or a poem at some point, or do you just write freely?
I try to write as freely as possible. I still, like, my concentration does, you know, go in that, in certain directions, you know, towards rhyming or,
yeah,
you know, or like following lines, you know, and trying to narrativize, or, you know, doing all these things. But eventually, when you have all, when I had all that writing and I could just look at it all as one big mass, then it starts to become less about what is rhyming with what and just which lines are really speaking to me and which lines are funny or which lines are, you know, emotionally resonating with me. And then writing just got to be really fun and fast.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's, wait a minute, to circle back, this song Limited Hangout is derived from that exercise technique, or does it relate to David in any other way?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely relates to David. David was definitely, I think, a huge part of this record for me. When he passed, it was like a pretty, I didn't know him very well at all, but just being a part of Drag City at that time and being very close with a lot of the people that worked there, it was, you know, a really intense time. Yeah. In an already very intense year. So his, you know, spirit, his specter, whatever, you know, his stuff just felt like really important, yeah, to the way that I was thinking of the record. Like, and I mean, I basically just had, you know, a copy of Actual Air and put all of his records on my phone. And
yeah,
you know, was like, I think he passed away the day that I flew to Europe and to go on tour with Wand. And then I just ended up just being sort of really puzzled by like, why? Why did this happen? Things were going so well.
Yeah.
And really feeling for all my friends who were very close with him. And friends that were going to go on tour with him at that time. And
And Woods and that, yeah, it's the worst. I don't know. I don't know what to say. I didn't know him very well, but we became friendly and he reached out to me, and I miss him very much. Like, just the fact that he reached out to me, and I mean, we became friendly. Yeah, we would exchange emails and messages, and it was kind of surreal to me because he was just such a huge figure in my life for as long as I can remember in some ways. And to your point, yeah, he was just about to go on tour anyway, I don't want to. Yeah, it's that's nice to hear. I mean, I guess the when you're grieving, you reciprocate and you commiserate, I suppose, as well. So I, as a fan and someone who got to know him a little bit, I appreciate that he meant something to you, and that he's part of this record in a way that I didn't really catch before. So I'm happy to play the song, and let's do it. Yeah, this is Limited Hangout by Corey Hansen from the wonderful new album, Pale Horse Rider. And Corey, we've never met. We've never spoken before. I had a really lovely time. I hope you did too, and I wish you the best luck with everything in the future.
Yeah, thanks, Vish. This was great. Thanks for having me.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. I did, and I'd like to once again thank Corey Hansen for appearing on this, the 608th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode you've heard about and you're looking for it, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit my website, vishkana.com. You can also like Creative Control on Facebook or follow the show on Twitter, @vishcreative. Or you can follow me directly on Twitter and on Instagram, @vishkana. Visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to the show. $6 or more grants you access to exclusive content. And also, if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, please just message me on Patreon and I will get you one while supplies last. Again, those Patreon donations are the primary manner in which this show receives any kind of, you know, financial compensation, remuneration, whatever the word is, money. That's the way we get the money. So again, if you'd like to give us some money, please go to patreon.com/creativecontrol and contribute whatever you can. Thanks again to liveatmasseyhall.com, where you can watch beautifully captured concerts by great Canadian artists, and also to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks, as always, to my friend Jim Guthrie. He's a lovely man who lends me some music for this particular show, and you can learn more about Jim at his website, jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode with Corey Hansen. I hope that you enjoyed it. He seems like a lovely person. I've never spoken to him before, but I really love his new album, and I like Wand. And so I like Drag City. It all just made sense. And he told some stories there, and it was good. I enjoyed it very much. So thank you for listening to this episode with Corey Hansen. Also, thank you for potentially subscribing to the podcast and maybe telling your friends about it, spreading the word about it if you like it. Maybe they'll like it too. All of that means a lot to me, and it helps. It helps the show a lot. So thank you very much. I will talk to you soon. Stay well. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.